Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Our program tonight is the Sierra Club at 125 years, from Yosemite to climate justice, with Bruce Hamilton, Deputy Executive Director of the Sierra Club. And now, Bruce, to you.
Thank you, Anne, and it's great to be here for the 125th birthday in the city of our birth. Sierra Club was founded in San Francisco and was headquartered here up until 2 years ago when we moved to Oakland. So I'm going to take you on a whirlwind tour of 125 years, but a different kind of history than probably most of you have ever heard. When the Sierra Club celebrated its centennial in 1992, it trotted out a timeline of major accomplishments. For example, in 1916, we helped establish the National Park Service, and a Sierra Club member, Stephen Mather, became the first director. In 1940, we added Kings Canyon to the National Park System. 1967, we stopped dams in the Grand Canyon in a very famous campaign. 1970, we helped pass the Clean Air Act. So if you follow the history that way, it reads like a steady stream of legislative and administrative victories. Wilderness parks, wild rivers were being established one after another. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, Toxic Substances Control Act, Superfund were passed to mandate the cleanup of all lands, air, and water. Power plants, factories, automobiles were required to pollute far less. Endangered species were to be fully protected, and steps taken to recover their populations and habitat. Meanwhile, the Sierra Club continued to grow and prosper. What started out as a few hundred people, primarily in San Francisco in the East Bay, who banded together as a hiking club with a passion of exploring, enjoying, and protecting the Sierra Nevada, grew into a powerful nationwide organization with 3 million members and supporters, 750 staff, 90 offices from Hawaii to Puerto Rico. But the history of the Sierra Club is far more complicated than that. Along with the substantial victories that we made the natural and the human environment a much better place, we've also made a number of mistakes. And we need to own up to those so that we can learn and adapt. As environmental challenges change, demographics change, technology changes, an organization also needs to adapt and change, or it will cease to be relevant and effective. I'm proud to say the Sierra Club is constantly changing and learning from our mistakes. And I think that's why we've lasted 125 years and why we're still one of the largest, most effective, and most respected environmental groups on the planet. But this change has not been easy, and I need to let you know it's still a work in progress. I share the stories that I'm sharing tonight, not to denigrate the Sierra Club that I love and grew up with, but just like the United States when Barack Obama talks about making it a more perfect union, we must steadily try to establish that more perfect organization that we aspire to become and not pretend that we figured it all out ahead of time. So with that as background, I want to take you on a brief and very incomplete Howard Zinn type history of the Sierra Club. It's made by talented, dedicated, well-meaning, but also fallible human beings. We'll start with John Muir, perhaps the most famous early conservationist, father of the preservation movement, and the founder of the Sierra Club. He's remembered and honored for his campaigns to protect Yosemite, the giant sequoias, and parks all across the West. His lyrical writings were an inspiration to key decision makers and millions of conservation-minded people worldwide. He was sought out by presidents, scientists, journalists, philanthropists, adventurers. They were all eager to get his advice and a dose of his enthusiasm for all things wild. Muir's mountaineering stories, accounts of the glories of nature, and appeals for the protection of these wild places inspired generations of conservationists all around the world up until today. Schools, hospitals, Muir Woods National Monument, Muir Woods National Historic Site out in Martinez, the California Commemorative Quarter. There's even a distant planet that's named to honor John Muir and his accomplishments. He's remembered largely for his natural history books and articles and championing the protection of places like Yosemite, Sequoia, the Pacific Northwest, Alaska, the Grand Canyon. But as historians dig deeper into John Muir's work, they pointed out a few extremely prejudiced statements in his books about his early encounters with African-American freed slaves right after the Civil War, as well as Native Americans whose tribes had been murdered, harassed, and displaced from Yosemite. Now, Muir had no role in the enslavement or the Jim Crow laws of the South, and most of the wars of extermination against the California Native Americans were waged before he ever set foot in California. Nevertheless, in his books, he disdainfully calls Afro-Americans and Native Americans that he met on his travels as dirty, lazy. He speculated that perhaps he'd like them more if he knew them better, but he made no attempt to do so. He expressed little empathy and no sense of responsibility for those fellow human beings that had been wronged. His published racist statements clearly tarnish his reputation and that of the organization he founded and would lead. These encounters and writings were from Muir's time when he was a young vagabond, before he founded the Sierra Club. In his later years, he appears to have evolved and writes in far more empathetic and complimentary terms about the indigenous people he meets in Alaska. Muir also joined the Sequoia Society, which was an organization dedicated to promoting Native American rights. And he described the campaign of Indian extermination and displacement as mean, brutal policy. So one can try to dismiss Muir's earlier comments as observations of a few individuals he met, and he had no intent to promote his prejudices. But you also need to look at the impact of his words, which are now read by millions in subsequent generations and called out by Muir critics. Words matter, and these words caused hurt, and they still cause hurt, and they perpetuate racial bias. Around the turn of the 19th century, when Muir was most active, there was also a vile and disturbing pseudoscience building off the theory of evolution called eugenics. Now, Northern Europeans were judged to be a superior race that this so-called science dictated should breed, thrive, and dominate all other races. Taken to its extremes, other so-called lower races, as well as those with disabilities, were supposed to be enslaved, dominated, sterilized, or in other ways kept in their subjugated position. This was white supremacy in its ugliest form, hiding behind a pseudoscience. It ultimately inspired Hitler and Nazi Germany to brutally promote their master race concept and promote mass genocide. Several prominent eugenicists, notably Madison Grant, who was one of the founders of the Save the Redwoods League, David Starr Jordan, who was the first president of Stanford University, Joseph LeConte Sr., a University of California professor, were contemporaries of Muir and friends of his through their joint work on conservation. Now, Muir never wrote about eugenics, so we have no idea what he thought of this theory, but it now taints many of the early conservation thinkers of his time, including some prominent club members. The theory was so dominant at the time that most states, including California, had laws promoting eugenics on the books. Forced sterilization of the mentally disabled was upheld by the Supreme Court in that era. The eugenics and white supremacy advocacy of these prominent individuals was something separate from their conservation advocacy, but now that it's come to light, it casts a different light on these individuals, and it taints their conservation legacies. Of all these individuals, Joseph LeConte Sr. is the one most closely associated with the Sierra Club. He was an early member, and his natural history writings and lectures and trailside talks were an inspiration for club members. He was scheduled to be the featured participant in the first ever Sierra Club outing that was held in 1901, when he suddenly died just before the hike in Yosemite was to begin. To honor his conservation teachings, the Sierra Club constructed the LeConte Memorial Lodge in Yosemite, which served as the first ever park visitor center before there was ever a National Park Service. It's only in recent years when the present Sierra Club leadership learned of LeConte's other life as a white supremacy advocate and lecturer, that the Sierra Club petitioned the National Park Service to change the name of the lodge. Now it's called the Yosemite Conservation Heritage Center. While we're on the subject of Yosemite, it's worth noting that some early conservation leaders fought on the other side of these debates. They were vocal critics of Native American displacement and mistreatment, and they were abolitionists. In 1891, a year before the Sierra Club was founded, a Yosemite artist called Charles Dorman Robinson is widely credited with drafting and promoting a petition to the United States on behalf of the surviving Miwok and Mono Native peoples who used to inhabit what is now Yosemite National Park. The petition cited the abuse to the land by the state of California, which was allowing the exploitation of Yosemite Valley, and it called for both better management of the valley and $1 million in reparations to surviving tribal members to compensate them for the lands that were stolen from them. Well, the petition fell on deaf ears, but it's interesting to note that Robinson was a charter member of the Sierra Club and a close friend of John Muir. In articles critical of early conservationists, a story is sometimes inaccurately told that preservationists sought the removal of Native Americans from their ancestral homes in order to establish national parks and wilderness areas. Well, this is partially true in Yellowstone, where the natives were driven away by the military to promote tourism, and in Glacier National Park in Montana, where they were forced to sell their land for cheap. In almost every case, the Native American displacement, decimation by effects of disease, extermination took place on behalf of miners, settlers, loggers, and grazers long before any conservationists were even active in the area. It was only after this relocation and extermination that some of these lands were later proposed as parks. But it's true that conservationists all too conveniently presumed that the lands were vacant and virgin wilderness, and they failed to acknowledge that Native people's legitimate claim to the land, and conservationists made no attempt to right the wrongs of the past. In this sense, if you believe, as Ken Burns did in his series, that national parks are America's greatest idea, they're built on a legacy of America's worst idea, that Western colonizers were entitled to take over all of the lands of North America as their own. So with this as background, we should still be thankful that for 125 years of Sierra Club and other conservationists working, we've saved more than 250 million acres of public lands. They've been set aside as parks, wilderness areas, preserves, wildlife refuges. Over 11,000 miles of wild rivers have been protected too. The Sierra Club and others had not stepped up to defend these wildlands, there'd be dams in the Grand Canyon, forest clear cuts in Olympic National Park, geothermal development drying up the geysers in Yellowstone National Park, oil and gas fields in the Bob Marshall Wilderness in Montana, a giant ski area in Mineral King, a nuclear power plant in Bodega Bay on an earthquake fault, a jet port in the Everglades. The record of protecting nature is truly a legacy worth celebrating. But what can we learn from this complicated and deeply troubled history? Clearly, one lesson is that we need to honor, consult, and accommodate the descendants of the original inhabitants of these lands and enable them to tell their stories. Also, going forward, we need to have a partnership with Indigenous people and other community members when we design new parks and refuges, or develop management plans for the existing conservation system units, keeping equity and justice in mind. One great example of this approach is the Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, designated by President Obama and now under attack by the Trump administration. The Sierra Club was interested in protecting the wild public lands around Canyonlands National Park, including the Bears Ears, but in learning from the past, we made a conscious effort to seek out local tribal members who also revered this land and wanted to see it protected from mineral development, off-road vehicles, and those that would destroy the Native American cultural sites. So we formed a coalition with the tribes, and we worked with them to determine the best boundaries for the new national monument and the best management prescription to accommodate traditional tribal cultural practices. The joint proposal, led by the tribes, was ultimately adopted by the Obama administration. And now the Trump administration seeks to undo the protection for these sacred lands. But it is the tribes, backed by the Sierra Club, that are taking the lead in the litigation and the defense of the monument. we can rally millions of voices nationally to come to a monument's defense, but we collaborate and defer to the tribes on the details and make sure that they have the resources and they have the access to have their voices heard. The result is a far more just, equitable, and powerful movement and outcome. Another example of this new approach was a successful effort to establish the San Gabriel National Monument outside of Los Angeles. These national forest lands are in the backyard of a large and diverse urban population, has a vital stake in the future of those lands. So while traditional, mostly white Sierra Club public lands advocates were primarily interested in protecting remote wilderness primitive recreation and undisturbed wildlife habitat, the local Latino allies were advocates for closer-to-home picnic areas, parking, swimming areas, restrooms, multilingual signage, so they could welcome new nature lovers who weren't ready to rough it in the backcountry. Ultimately, working together, the community groups and the conservationists were able to develop a joint proposal that promoted both types of recreation, and a broad, diverse coalition was established to encourage President Obama to sign the proclamation and protect the area. And when he came down there and I was there with him, he praised the coalition and said, "You've made my job easy because you've worked out all the details and brought everybody together. This is the kind of thing that a president loves to do." This monument is also under threat by the Trump administration. As we look ahead to the future, we need to embrace this model to include justice and equity and community partners in our campaigns to protect the next 100 million acres of wildlands and nearby nature. We also need to look back and see how we can correct any injustices that were enacted as parks and other protected areas were established. The Sierra Club also has a checkered past related to energy development. Sure, we were in the forefront of stopping a dam in Dinosaur National Monument in the 1950s, but the end result was the placement of a dam downstream in Glen Canyon. The club members at the time did not know, and they didn't value because it wasn't in a national park. Once our leaders finally saw Glen Canyon, they regretted the trade-off, and they tried in vain to save that special place too. Similarly, by stopping the dams in the Grand Canyon in the 1960s, the Sierra Club probably accelerated the development of the huge Navajo coal-fired power plant, which today pollutes the Grand Canyon region and contributes significantly to climate catastrophe. We now have campaigns to drain Glen Canyon and retire the Navajo plant and replace it with clean energy. Closer to home in California, the Sierra Club headed off that nuclear power plant I described earlier in Bodega Bay and situated right on top of the San Andreas Fault. That one was straightforward. But when another coastal nuke was proposed for Nimpomo Dunes south of San Luis Obispo, the club joined forces to protect the dunes and promote it as a state park. In the process, the club met with PG&E officials, who under pressure finally agreed to move their plant to a little-known site called Diablo Canyon. The Sierra Club board and senior staff had a fierce internal debate, but ultimately a majority of the board voted not to oppose the siting of the plant in Diablo Canyon. Now we know what a mistake that was, because Diablo Canyon also sits in a major earthquake fault. At the start of my Sierra Club career in the 1970s, the Sierra Club was fighting acid rain from the burning of high sulfur coal that was killing fish and trees, high mountain lakes. The proposed solution was to put sulfur scrubbers on the smokestacks and to burn more low sulfur coal that you would primarily strip mine in the West. When strip mining was destroying the mountains of Appalachia and the high plains in the West, the solution was to adopt the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. It's one of the first things I ever worked on with a coalition against strip mining. These were important steps in stopping the pollution problems, but looking back, a generation of less polluting coal-fired power plants and coal mines were permitted, which continued to accelerate climate change. Now today, the Sierra Club is working to retire those same power plants and mines that were opened on my watch, and they're now being forced to clean up. Later on, when the Sierra Club found the substitution of natural gas for dirty coal to be a great public health and clean air benefit, but only later did we understand that natural gas combined with fracking technology damages groundwater, threatens communities, and is a greenhouse gas calamity. We thought that stopping coal-fired power plants and having a utility switch to natural gas was a climate and a pollution victory. Natural gas was viewed as a bridge fuel to a clean energy future. But with better information on the true climate impacts of producing and burning natural gas, we concluded it was not a bridge, but instead it was a gangplank into an ocean of dirty fossil fuels. Soon we were opposing all fracking, all new natural gas generation, and promoting 100% clean energy. Only in the last decade, with technology breakthroughs and the falling price of clean energy, has the Sierra Club realized that 100% clean energy is the policy we should be promoting now and should have been promoting much earlier. Now we oppose all fossil fuel and nuclear power generation. In keeping with our commitment to justice and equity, we're also advocates for a just transition for workers employed in the fossil fuel and nuclear industry. So as we successfully argue for the retirement of existing dirty facilities, we also advocate for dedicated funds for worker retraining and investment in clean energy replacement facilities that provide good-paying green jobs.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the Sierra Club at 125 years, from Yosemite to climate justice, with Bruce Hamilton, Deputy Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Bruce?
Thank you. On the climate change front, the club was an early advocate of curtailing greenhouse gas emissions. We were one of the first conservation groups to publish books and magazine articles about climate change and to run successful national campaign to promote higher automobile truck fuel efficiency standards and curtail tailpipe emissions that contribute to climate change. But some of our environmental colleagues and political leaders were intrigued by market-based solutions to climate change and believed that the only legislative solution that was politically possible was something called cap and trade. This would allow a polluting factory to avoid cleaning up its own emissions in exchange for paying the cleanup of emissions somewhere else, as long as the global reduction in projected emissions was the same or greater. This approach would clearly benefit the company financially, as it could find the cheapest cleanup option. But for those communities living next to a polluting plant, they weren't required to clean up. It meant continued pollution and adverse health impacts, leading to environmental injustice. So planting trees in a remote place to soak up carbon emissions is not an acceptable substitute for ending toxic emissions that real people in poor communities have to breathe. Once again, if you don't consult and involve the impacted communities in the decision-making, you can come up with unjust and unwise approaches that are not real solutions at all. I want to briefly honor the amazing coalition of community leaders, Native Americans, clean energy industry workers, mayors, climate activists that managed to defeat almost every new proposed coal-fired power plant in the United States that was on the drawing boards over the past decades. Now we're in the process of retiring all existing coal plants. Our Beyond Coal campaign and its partners have retired 262 coal-fired power plants in 7 years, representing 121,000 megawatts of power. And that's one plant retired every 9 days during the Trump presidency. This leaves 261 remaining dirty power plants, totaling 221 megawatts still to go. So we still have a lot of work ahead. We're also moving city by city to get mayors to commit to convert their cities to 100% clean energy within the next few years to build the demand for clean energy. We already have 150 mayors in 33 states signed up. Our audacious but realistic goal is to clean the entire electric grid of all dirty fuel by 2030, and then to have all sectors, transportation, housing, manufacturing, electricity, dirty fuel free by 2050. These steps, plus others taken by the state and local levels and the transportation sector, are actually keeping the United States on track to meet or exceed its Paris climate agreements, even though the Trump administration wants to pull the U.S. out of Paris and cancel the Clean Power Plan. The People's Climate Movement that was assembled to promote climate justice is another model of a broad and diverse coalition that includes frontline communities, workers, Native Americans, businesses, extreme weather impacted community leaders, scientists, people of faith, environmentalists. We're all under a common banner To change everything, we need everybody. This was not the approach that the Sierra Club and others used 20 years ago when we saw climate change strictly as an environmental issue. I'd now like to turn and examine another historic misstep by the Sierra Club and the environmental movement around population stabilization and immigration. The Sierra Club's first major venture into the population issue came in 1968, when the club and Ballantine Books jointly published a book by Paul Ehrlich titled The Population Bomb. It warned of a likely mass starvation of humans in the 1970s and 1980s due to overpopulation, as well as other major societal upheavals, and it advocated immediate action to limit the population growth. Some of Ehrlich's solutions were embraced by the Sierra Club, including better contraceptives, universal access to family planning, better guaranteed sex education for all, and legislative legal access to protect the woman's right to choose. But other solutions to avert mass starvation were more coercive and highly controversial, including prenatal sex discernment, mass sterilizing agents, forced sterilization in some countries if males had more than three children already. These controversial positions were widely condemned and criticized in the developing countries. They were not adopted by the Sierra Club. The major turning point in the conservation community and the world community was in September 1994, when the United Nations International Conference on Population and Development happened in Cairo, Egypt. Coming out of that conference, there emerged a new international agenda, shifting away from reducing population growth by government regulation and instead embracing women's health, education, access to family planning services, so that they could make their own decisions on reproduction and family size. And these are the principles that remain the core of the Sierra Club's new gender equity program today. The most contentious element of the Sierra Club's approach to population was a 1989 policy advocating limiting immigration into the United States to stabilize our own country's population. This policy remained on the books until 1996, when the board adopted a new policy saying that we would be neutral on the issue of immigration limitations, and instead we were going to focus on women's education, empowerment, access to family planning, and address the root causes of migration instead. But this position of neutrality on immigration didn't sit well with a faction of the Sierra Club and those outside that wanted to see us maintain our immigration restriction policy. They believed that advocating for strict immigration was essential. So in an effort to overturn the board's adopted policy, they qualified a petition to put on the Sierra Club ballot before the entire membership. In 1998, the immigration issue was voted on by the membership. The issue was complicated by the fact that some outside nativist groups decided to heavily lobby the Sierra Club and its membership to adopt the anti-immigrant position. The board, a majority of our chapters, actively campaigned to maintain the neutrality position, and it was ultimately soundly defeated by the membership. The anti-immigration faction also ran a slate of candidates for the board of directors seeking to take it over to change the policy, but that slate was defeated by a membership vote. Unfortunately, all this internal debate tarnished the reputation of the Sierra Club, and it eroded trust with the immigrant rights community and many others. 2013, the Sierra Club took additional steps to support immigrant rights. The board unanimously endorsed the position of supporting an equitable pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. We also supported the DACA and DAPA programs to protect dreamers and their families from deportation, and we opposed the border wall. By establishing an equitable path to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented immigrants living in America today, our president wrote, we can empower those in our society who are most vulnerable to toxic pollution to fully participate in our democracy, fight back against the polluters, and demand public health protections and clean energy solutions. Well, we're still working to build trust with immigrant rights community, and we're joining in solidarity in events to resist the anti-immigrant policies of the Trump administration. I'd also like to draw attention to the Sierra Club's embrace of technology and social media as a way of engaging and building a broader and more diverse movement. Back in the 1950s and even into the 1970s, we were a Sierra Club with an emphasis on the word club. We talk primarily to the members of our club and organize them to send in snail mail letters or make phone calls to influence elected officials on issues. And by and large, we were successful. The victories that we had in those decades came with those kind of tactics.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Occasionally, we'd run a full-page ad in the New York Times, or promote a slideshow, or publish a book to draw attention to our campaigns. But most of the time, we were still mobilizing a very small universe of card-carrying environmentalists and club members. That worked for a while, but soon other interest groups, including our adversaries, were doing the same, and our impact diminished. Fast forward to today, where the Sierra Club has a nationwide network of on-the-ground organizers and digital organizers. We host in-person meetings, rallies, marches, protests. We have millions of online supporters who develop and participate in online campaigns. And they share the messages with their friends and their own networks. We produce and distribute messages through dozens of traditional and new communications channels, from YouTube videos to text alerts, email blasts, blogs. Within a matter of hours, we can mobilize supporters to action and create political momentum to promote our campaigns. The Sierra Club's online content, tools, and talent are among the best in the business, and they serve as a vital complement to our more traditional on-land, face-to-face organizing and community engagement. In summary, the Sierra Club is no longer a club that is organized inward. We now have a network of millions to partner with, inform, and engage. We're focused on movement building, mass mobilizations, and coalitions that produce the kinds of numbers and diversity that force decision makers to respond to our demands for a just and sound environmental policy. Today, the Sierra Club has the most comprehensive and most complete campaign toolbox of any environmental nonprofit. We have staff and volunteers who can lobby at the local, state, national, and international levels. We have a political action committee. We have a huge network of staff and volunteer lawyers who bring over 100 lawsuits each year. We have on land and online digital organizers. We produce print and web-based newsletters, alerts, updates, videos. We organize rallies, marches, protests, public meetings. We teach outdoor skills and lead thousands of outdoor adventures to bring people closer to nature. We support other progressive partners to protect their rights and enable them to fully participate in the democratic process. We partner with and recognize businesses when they're helping to lead and solve environmental problems. We do not rely on any single forum or campaign tool to solve our problems. So when one avenue is blocked by our opponents, we can continue to make progress on other fronts. I'd now like to turn back to the issue of environmental justice that I raised earlier. For the Sierra Club's first 100 years, its leaders and members didn't think much about environmental justice. We were an insular, largely white, largely well-educated and affluent organization. So were the other major national environmental organizations. Then in March 1990, a shot came across our bow of the major national and international environmental organizations from an unlikely source, the Southwest Organizing Project and its allies on the front lines of environmental justice. The letter called out the impact on low-income and people of color communities by the military, mining, and energy companies and polluting industries. But then it rightly turned its attention to the complicity of the large environmental groups. The letter read, "Although environmental organizations often claim to represent our interests, in observing your activities, it has become clear to us that your organizations play an equal role in the disruption of our communities. Your organizations continue to support and promote policies which emphasize the cleanup and preservation of the environment on the backs of working people in general and people of color in particular. In the name of eliminating environmental hazards at any cost, across the country, industrial and other economic activities which employ us are being shut down, curtailed, or prevented, while our survival needs and cultures are ignored. We suffer from the end results of these actions, but are never full participants in the decision-making which leads to them. Our first response was defensive. Were we really the problem? But upon deeper reflection and deep, direct conversation, we then came to realize we were the problem and we needed to be part of the solution. This wake-up call was taken seriously by the Sierra Club, and we started a dialogue that led to a number of changes in our organization and the way we relate to and listen to environmental justice frontline groups. We are a work in progress, and we're far from where we need to be to fully embrace equity, justice, and inclusion in our internal and our external work. But we're on a journey, and it's a vital one for the future of the planet, for the future of the environmental movement, and of the Sierra Club. One early step was in 1993. We developed an environmental justice program and adopted environmental justice principles for the organization. This program was designed to serve at the invitation of local environmental justice groups to provide them with organizing skills, media skills, and other forms of support so that they could be more successful in their campaigns to get their outcomes. The specific direction to our organizers was to remain in the background and not seek creditor publicity, but to become a trusted community partner to help them win victories and make positive change in their lives. We also started educating our own membership and the public to the shocking facts about environmental racism and injustice. In 1994, the Sierra Club published Unequal Protection, Environmental Justice and Communities of Color by Robert Bullard, the father of the environmental justice movement. Now we celebrate leaders with an annual Robert Bullard Award for work in environmental justice arena. We also seek out opportunities to stand in solidarity with impacted labor, low-income, people of color communities on issues from Black Lives Matter to immigration reform, stopping the border wall, voting rights, to the fight for a living wage. This month, our environmental justice organizer in Puerto Rico is working with local Spanish-speaking chapter leaders to help the most vulnerable frontline communities flattened and flooded by the climate-intensified Hurricane Maria. Our members and supporters donated $1.2 million to relief efforts online, and we're working with and providing those relief grants to local community groups that get 100% of those donations directly to the suffering communities. In addition to those grants, we partnered with the good folks at Casa Pueblo and have arranged for the delivery of 1,000 solar lanterns to the island, a first step in an ongoing project to bring light to the hardest hit communities, which may not get power restored for the next 4 to 6 months, while showing the power of solar can help serve critical needs. This sort of action is not what traditional environmental groups do, but it is what the modern Sierra Club is stepping up to do. Once the island has recovered and our local volunteers can return to working, and they can build out that clean energy future for the island, get back to saving sea turtles, cleaning up toxic waste dumps, or getting families out into nature, it's all important work in order to protect the human and the natural environment. And similar efforts are underway in hurricane-impacted communities in Texas and Florida with local leaders and on-the-ground organizers. People sometimes ask me what I'm most proud of in my 40 years at the Sierra Club. At mid-career, I used to say it was my work to enact the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act in 1980. In that campaign, we doubled the size of the National Park System and the National Wild and Scenic River System and protected over 100 million acres in one gigantic bill that took more than a decade to accomplish. But now, with greater reflection, I'm most proud of a Sierra Club for adopting a multi-year equity, justice, and inclusion plan in 2015. That plan was coupled with a budget commitment that enabled us to hire excellent staff to drive the plan through our equity department to completion. In that part of that plan, it requires all staff to attend equity training and to develop equity components in their annual work plans. This is transforming the Sierra Club in ways that I feel will lead us into the next century. Now, when we start to develop a plan to save a wild place, clean up a polluting factory, fight dirty fuel project, our campaigners are required to factor in justice and equity and movement building with partner organizations at the front end. It takes longer, but ultimately the campaign is built around justice and equity and its likelihood of getting a just solution is much more possible and much more enduring. This is the only way forward in the next 125 years for organizations such as the Sierra Club. Together, we'll be able to tackle the huge environmental and justice challenges that lie before us. The Sierra Club's mission is to explore, enjoy, and protect the wild places of the earth, to practice and promote the responsible use of the earth's ecosystems and resources, to educate and enlist humanity to protect and restore the quality of the natural and the human environment, and to use all lawful means to carry out those objectives. Enlisting humanity requires that we include all of humanity in our big tent, and that we help address social justice as well as environmental justice issues. It used to be that I would do my working for the Sierra Club during the day, and then separately after hours, work with various social justice groups. It's heartening and a sign of real change and progress to see these movements converging, recognizing their common mission, and moving forward together at last. Thank you.
Our program tonight is the Sierra Club at 125 years from Yosemite to climate justice with Bruce Hamilton, Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Now it's time for our audience questions, and I get to read them, so I'm going to try and do it. What is the position of the Sierra Club on the proposed increase in natural park admission fees, in addition to voicing disapproval on the website of this proposal? What can people do? What is the Sierra Club doing to protect the access, low-cost access?
All right. For those not familiar with this, the Trump administration has come out with a proposal to double the entrance fee during the peak summer months in 17 major national parks, including Yosemite, Yellowstone, Grand Teton, the Grand Canyon. So as opposed to $20 or $30 to take a vehicle into Yosemite, instead it would be $70. And we're opposed to this. We feel that it's economically discriminatory. They basically want to do this so that they can raise, they think, $70 million that will then help build and allow them to do the maintenance backlog. You know, frankly, they're cutting the budget for the National Park Service so that they can't maintain the parks, and then they're turning around and trying to create an economically exclusive park that only the rich can go to then turn around and cover up for the fact that they've slashed the park budget. This only came out yesterday, so we don't have everything unfolded. We've blogged on it. We've sent out a press release, but we will be doing alerts. There is a public comment period. It'll be an opportunity for all of you, and if you go to sierraclub.org, you can find those alerts, or if you're a club member, maybe one will show up in your mailbox or in your ad up or your Twitter feed or wherever you are.
What can be done about the Paris Accord?
Well, the Paris Accord is going to survive. You know, every country except Syria has committed to this. And the United States now wants to pull out, though Donald Trump can't unilaterally pull out until 2020. But he almost certainly will. I think the point is that Paris is going to survive. Everybody has re-upped and recommitted. So rather than Donald Trump leading a stampede away from Paris, he has just got everybody else to dig in and say, we're there, we're serious, we're going to make this happen. You know, another holdout was Nicaragua because the pact wasn't strong enough. And Nicaragua finally said, if Trump doesn't like it, I like it. So now they've endorsed it too. So, you know, we really have the entire world community there. And as I mentioned in my talk, basically, Donald Trump can brag all he wants to about bringing back the coal industry and about how climate change is a hoax brought on by the Chinese, but he's not able to change the laws of physics, and he's not able to change the laws of economics. And right now, solar, wind, natural gas are all cheaper than coal, and coal continues to go down. And as I said, we've even accelerated the rate that we're retiring coal-fired power plants since Donald Trump came in and said that he was going to stop the war on coal. The war on coal continues until it's gone and people's health all across the United States is protected and restored. So Paris is going to do just fine, and we will survive until there's a new administration that isn't full of climate deniers. But regardless of what Donald Trump does, we will move forward and address this issue because it's essential that we do, and the rest of the world understands that.
There was a person who was on one of the TV shows saying that 4,000 scientists support Trump in his climate assessment. Do you have a response to that? 4,000 scientists.
I don't know how many scientists there are in the world, but I would say that this is less than 0.001% of the scientific community that supports Trump in this, and I would guess that most of them are on industry's payroll, and so they're being paid to think that. But anybody who's studied the science, I mean, it's kind of like you can find 4,000 scientists somewhere that probably think tobacco doesn't cause lung cancer. But the vast majority of the scientific evidence clearly indicates that it's anthropogenic, and we got to do something about it now.
Is the Sierra Club working towards placing solar panels on existing buildings in areas that are not wilderness, such as farms and warehouses? Clean energy should not be using, clean energy, wind farms and solar panels. Should not be using deserts and other natural areas. I'm not sure I'm getting that correct.
I get the drift of it. So the question is, if you're going to be deploying large wind farms or solar collectors, are you going to have big industrial farms out in rural areas or in the California desert, or are you going to try to put as many solar rooftop panels as possible? The answer is both. That it would be great. I mean, there actually are enough rooftops in the country that you could supply all the power for this country just if you got. But, going through convincing every individual homeowner and business to go put solar collectors up on their roof and dealing with the homeowners associations and everything, it just happens too slowly. So, yes, we want to have distributed solar. We want everybody to put solar on their roof. I've got solar on my roof. But on top of that, we also need to be having some central stations. And it's also just a way of evening out things, that if you have some central power generation, you've got enough megawatts together there that you can ship them around. So what happens when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow? Isn't this going to be unreliable? Well, if you have the kind of smart energy grid, you can then turn around and ship it, because the wind will be blowing in the night, the sun during the day. If the sun's behind clouds here, it's sunny somewhere else. So it's important that you have a grid as well as people being independent and having their own solar collector on their own roof. But distributed energy and having it on your own roof is less impactful. And the other thing is, we don't support all solar in every location on public lands. So there's actually a zoning that has taken place under the Obama administration, which now may get thrown out by Trump again, that basically tried to steer solar development in the desert to the areas that were least impactful of desert tortoises and other endangered species. So we do support both, and frankly, in order to solve the climate crisis, we just have to deploy rapidly in every direction to make this work, and everybody's going to have to suck it up a little. You may not like it if your neighbor just put a solar collector on your roof and you have to look at it from your dining room table, but would you rather breathe dirty air and have climate catastrophe? So some of both. I mean, wind farms kill some birds, but you can put them in better places where they kill fewer birds. You can have a different configuration of the wind farms. You can shut them down certain migration seasons. But you don't just turn around and say wind farms are bad because some birds and bats get killed. Frankly, climate change kills more birds and bats than wind farms ever will.
Here in San Francisco, there have been pro-business market solution candidates that ran for the board. I'm assuming the Sierra Club board. Though they were not successful, do you have any concerns about a stealth campaign to change the leadership?
I'm going to dodge that one. I don't know the issue. I don't know the people. All I can say is, the Sierra Club is a democracy. Anybody can join. Anybody can run for our board. And it's important that we have an educated electorate that participates. And I think as long as we got lots of members and those members are informed and they participate in elections, we'll be able to protect ourselves. But I don't know about whatever candidate and whatever stealth campaign may or may not be happening.
how would you compare China's reaction to climate change and climate, we hope, justice, compared to what's now presently in Washington, D.C. and being promulgated? Meaning Mr. Trump, I think they mean.
Yeah. Well, first, from a legacy emissions standpoint, you know, the United States is now the second largest polluter on the planet after China. But if you look at historic contributions, we've been industrialized a lot longer. So most of the junk that's up there in the atmosphere and going to be there for hundreds of years is our responsibility. So yes, China's got, you know, huge problems and is contributing a lot. They also, because they have a centralized state, are able to make a lot of decisions much more quicker than we can in our democracy. And so they are deploying windmills far faster than us. They are deploying solar collectors far faster than us. You know, they're on a track to be 100% electric vehicles. You know, so they're moving faster in many ways than California, which is leading the United States in these efforts. But, you know, are they still building some coal-fired power plants? Are they still choking on pollution? Are they still putting lots up into the atmosphere? Yes. But I do think that they understand the message. You know, they're seeing drought, they're seeing famine, they're seeing heat, they're seeing climate-induced deaths and severe weather, and their scientists are not in climate denial.
This question is the question of incremental progress, i.e. natural gas in previous decades, versus more stringent stands is a vexing one. Are there particular approaches, questions, or frames of mind you find useful when weighing these questions?
Well, I think on something like natural gas, there's been evolving policy. I don't even like the term natural gas. It makes it sound so benign. We just ought to call it methane or something that really is dirty. But it is another dirty fossil fuel. And if you look at the entire life cycle of natural gas, with all the leakages that take place at the wellhead, at the pipeline, at the storage tanks, at the end use, it's just spewing lots of methane up into the atmosphere. And that methane is much more of a potent greenhouse gas than the carbon dioxide that comes out of a coal-fired power plant. So when you start comparing the impact of the full cycle of natural gas, not just burning it in the power plant, but the entire cycle and all the leakage, and compare it with coal-fired power plants, some people say it's pretty comparable. So the idea of natural gas being some climate solution and being clean and it's an important bridge fuel just doesn't cut it. Now, it is cleaner burning, so I would rather live next to a natural gas plant than I'd live next to a coal-fired power plant, but that's hardly a trade-off. We don't need either. So we're busy trying to make sure that there are no new natural gas plants deployed. We've got some existing ones. You know, we can't instantly shut them all down, but they ultimately need to be shut down because they're climate killers as well. And so I just, there was a time when we didn't have the capacity and the economics and the availability of clean power to turn around and just leapfrog dirty fossil fuels. That's no longer the case. There is no reason we ought to be building another natural gas plant in this country. We can just replace them all and then go back and start getting the existing fleet.
Does the Sierra Club have a long-term plan, 5 years, 10 years, things that you would like to accomplish as a club? And what are the most important ones that you'd like?
Yeah, so we have a long-term strategic plan. It looks at what we want to do in the next 3 to 5 years. It looks at what we want to do by 2030. It looks at what we want to do by 2050. So earlier on, you know, I said that we want to clean the entire electric grid of all dirty fossil fuels by 2030 and then clean all energy by 2050 of dirty fuels. In the next 3 to 5 years, we've got a schedule of which particular power plants we're going to be bringing down. So there's a certain number of megawatts that we're going to continue to press to retire. The same thing is true if you look at what we're trying to do with a lands protection agenda or any other agenda that we have. You know, there's specific benchmarks. Now, those benchmarks we had two different scenarios. One, what happens if Hillary Clinton gets elected? What happens if Donald Trump gets elected? So we had different scenarios depending upon that. Were we going to make even faster progress, or were we going to be basically in a holding pattern? You know, we can't expect Donald Trump to turn around and designate any new national monuments. In fact, he's trying to undo the existing ones we have. So that's no longer a viable short-term plan. You know, what we're trying to do during the remainder of the Trump years, which hopefully are very few, is to prevent him from any serious undermining of the basic underlying statutes. That he has some executive authority to turn around and just say, we aren't going to enforce this law, and then we can turn around and sue him, you know, or this regulation we're going to rewrite, but it takes a long time to rewrite that regulation. You know, so we're just hoping that we can basically outlive him and stop the damage from happening too bad, and then go back and make progress. As long as he can't turn around and repeal the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, all those basic underlying statutes. And frankly, he can't as long as we've got enough people in the Senate to turn around and filibuster and stop them from having the votes in order to go do that. But hopefully with this next election cycle, not only will we increase the environmental minorities, but hopefully make them majorities in both the House and the Senate. And that way, Trump wouldn't be able to go anywhere with his plans.
Unfortunately, we reached that point in our program for our last question, and I'm the one who gets to ask it since I'm chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum. My question is a personal one. What do you see for you in the next few years? What are your goals? What would you like to really see happen, and how would that help us all to understand all of what you've talked about tonight?
Ooh, my Christmas list. Well, I just mentioned elections, so I'll just tell you, I mean, there is an election this November in New Jersey and Virginia and a few other places. I'd like to see that where the best environmental candidates won. In 2018, I would love to see a pro-environment Congress restored, at least in one house, but hopefully both houses. I don't want to leave. And, you know, I can't retire right now when Donald Trump's got a stranglehold on the environment. So I'm 66. I would love to retire at some point, but I'm not going to let this guy steal my legacy. And then there's just a lot more to do. I mean, I mentioned that there's 100 million acres of additional land that qualifies as wilderness and national parks. This Friday, tomorrow, I'm flying off to Seattle, and I'm meeting with a new generation of wilderness and parks advocates. I'm going to give them a talk somewhat like this that talks about how you need to incorporate justice and equity and do things like we did in Bears Ears or San Gabriel's in order to have big, broad coalitions to protect that next bunch of acres. But it's great that it's not just a bunch of graybeards that are gathering that are all white, but instead we're going to have a new generation that is much more diverse and able to use the new technology tools and hopefully mobilize millions, and that way we'll be successful. And when all those things happen and those people take charge, then I'll feel like I can sit back and walk the John Muir Trail again.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the Sierra Club at 125 years, from Yosemite to climate justice, with Bruce Hamilton, Deputy Executive Director of the Sierra Club. A big hand of applause and thanks to Bruce Hamilton.
Well, thank you for coming, and hopefully you'll all go home and write your postcards and join the resistance.
Our thanks and applause to our wonderful audience here before you leave. So let's have an applause for all of you who have come and had this wonderful talk that we've heard tonight, and especially for Bruce. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.